content of this program is intended for a blind and print impaired audience. Hello, this is Nicole Hunter from the Triangle Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the Essence Magazine July and August 2008 edition. So let's go ahead and get started. First article is The Joy That Keeps Giving. Aisha Oyibi, a major force behind the campaign, hashtag Bring Back Our Girls, is championing a brighter future for Nigerian women. It's the middle of April and Aisha is in Lagos, Nigeria. She's there to mark the 4-year anniversary of the kidnapping of 276 Nigerian girls from the village of Chibok by an insurgent Islamic extremist group called Boko Haram. It was a horrific display of force and violence that spawned the trending hashtag, hashtag Bring Back Our Girls, which was tweeted by everyone from Michelle Obama to the Pope. What many people may not know is that Aisha played a pivotal role as a co-founder of the campaign that brought widespread attention to the missing girls. Though she doesn't seek the limelight, she's been working tirelessly for women's rights in Nigeria for decades. Her mission, to help women access the fundamental right to education and secure a happy, successful future. For Aisha, the education of women and girls has always been a critical issue, and one that hits close to home. Quote, my father was from northern Nigeria, so I came from a family of Islamic scholars who in the past thought it was important to educate the boys and not the girls, end quote. She says, her father, however, didn't believe that. Instead, he insisted she stay in school. I'm the first girl in my family who didn't get married at 13, and it was because my father really understood the value of education. That doesn't mean she didn't meet resistance along the way. Aisha's father, General Murtala Muhammad, who was Nigeria's head of state in the 70s, was assassinated when she was just 12. With her father gone, many of her uncles questioned what a woman needed and with an education. They thought I would be headstrong and difficult and not able to find a man to marry. She says, laughing, although she would indeed grow up to be a headstrong leader, she proved them wrong, too. Not only has Aisha earned multiple degrees, including an MBA and a law degree, but she's also a married mother of three. In addition, the scholar just completed the first year of a PhD program at the University of London, focusing her studies on women in conflict with the goal of impacting policy on the international stage. If all this weren't enough, Aisha is a serial entrepreneur. She's currently overseeing retail and construction businesses in Nigeria and sits on the board of multiple companies and schools, including the Women's Leadership Board of Harvard Kennedy School's Women and Public Policy Program. Aisha continues to push further on both her own business goals and through her humanitarian work simply because she wants Nigeria to be as prosperous as it can be. Her efforts have created significant inroads in eventually bringing large multinational retail chains to Nigeria, from major jewelry companies to international hotel groups. As a businesswoman, she's playing the long game, investing in her country's infrastructure and its people. The more business we can attract into our country and build partnerships, the more we can share knowledge so we can see the growth in our economies, she says. Aisha concedes that she couldn't have accomplished half of what she's done without her education. I was able to go to school beyond the limits that were set for me. I know the value that education brings to a woman's life, she says. But if you look at the statistics for Muslim women in northern Nigeria, by secondary school, the majority of them drop out. We have one of the highest rates in the world of women above the age of 15 who are illiterate. That's not a good statistic at all. It was stats like that that ultimately compelled Aisha to bring or to create an international outcry after the Boko Haram kidnappings. Boko Haram literally means Western education is forbidden. The intimidation tactics used to keep girls from receiving an education is what incensed her. To be clear, these kidnappings had been occurring long before the Western world took notice. A month and a half before the movement began, Boko Haram had actually gone into another school and killed a large number of boys and locked the girls in a room and told them to never return to class. It was not a new thing, but I think what happened in Chibok Village was exceptionally shocking because they took 276 girls in one go from one school, she says. It just didn't make any sense. I called activists I worked with and said, what are we going to do about this? They joined forces to start a movement to bring the girls home. But Aisha doesn't see anything particularly special about what she did. She was merely doing what she felt was right. Though the work is endless, of her sense of altruism is her fuel. Those girls deserved a better future. And Aisha was not going to leave them behind. I can't imagine that something like this would happen to my children and no one would come out and protest, she says. The goal was to simply bring them back. And while her strategy has been somewhat successful, Aisha knows the hashtag is not enough. I worry sometimes that the real issues that have been drowned in the symbolism, she says, it's really important to remind everyone that not only is the Chibok issue still alive, but of the girls who were taken by Boko Haram and didn't escape, only 107 have been returned. They have 112 girls still in captivity. And 4 years later, how is it that dozens of girls could have been kidnapped from another school in the same region? Earlier this year in the northeastern Nigerian village of Dapchi, more girls were taken into captivity, and five were reportedly killed in the process. So the fight continues. During her visit to mark the four-year anniversary, Aisha went to the United Nations office in Lagos to seek their help in bringing home the remaining girls. The kidnapping in Chibok not only threw a spotlight on the issue of the abduction of women and girls, but also the general violence against women and girls that has been the hallmark of this insurgency, she says. We need active support. The Nigerian government cannot do it alone. This goes beyond just our borders. We are looking at the largest scourge of terrorism in the region. It would be easy to see how someone might give up in the face of such an oppressive force, but not Aisha. She says her upbringing has helped her remain steadfast, and she credits her mother, herself an entrepreneur who helped women in rural communities with trade, with instilling in her the drive to do what's right. My mother always said you should never look away from anyone in need. You have a responsibility to give back. Aisha has never forgotten. In 2002, she, along with other members of her family, created the Murtala Muhammad Foundation in her father's memory while simultaneously honoring the hard work she saw her mother doing every day. The foundation is centered on education. There's the policy arm that advocates for women, like those kidnapped by Boko Haram. Then there's the humanitarian work that improves underserved schools. Through her leadership, Aisha has been able to bring computer labs to more than 50 schools in the nation, pushing students to take an interest in STEM and generally improving their digital literacy. While the school programs are for all students, Aisha takes a particular interest in the girls. She knows how difficult it is to get them to stay in school, not only because of the cultural biases, but also the literal threat to their safety when they show up. better resources help and remind her that there's more to strive for even in the face of immense obstacles. You can't imagine the excitement when we go into these schools and the computers, says Aisha. It instantly elevates the status of the school, and the children feel differently about their education. We get letters after they've graduated telling us how much of an impact the computers made. Beyond formal schooling, Aisha has also set her sights on a female entrepreneurs like herself. The foundation's Women in Development initiatives have helped create cross-country mentorship programs so women can get support from other African entrepreneurs, as well as training and knowledge from workshops. For instance, Aisha and the former president of Malawi, Joyce Banda, host a talk for women traders. It's important education through exposure, Aisha says, so the women who are leading Nigeria's economy continue to dream big and see the impact they can have beyond their country's borders. Nigeria's economy is largely driven by women, but most of them are part of what we call the underground economy. They trade goods, but their work is not formally recognized by the state, she says. It's one of the things that we keep pushing for. If the women can receive more recognition for their work and contributions to the economy, I know they'll be able to accomplish even more. Aisha has lofty goals for her country, but she is evidence of the power of education and perseverance. She wants to keep the stories of her people, of both their struggle and their great prosperity, at the forefront. Later this year, she is going to release her first book, titled The Daughters of Chibok, Tragedy and Resilience in Nigeria's Northeast. It's important that the story of the missing girls don't become old news, even if the hashtag has been forgotten. She will tell the story and continue to push for the education of all women. I think Africa is the most beautiful place, and I think we have so much potential, she says. And the only way we can actualize that potential is if we continue to empower future generations of African children and create a strong place within our society for women and girls. It's wonderful to be able to make a change, to be able to positively impact people's lives. Sometimes it's just small incremental changes that end up being human. So moving on to another story. Decoding happiness. In the age of hashtags and hustle, happiness seems like an easy thing to spot in others, yet harder and harder to find within. Writer and realist Sharon R. Boone shares how she made peace with joy. I have always had a strange relationship with emotions since I was little. I've been drawn to the extremes rather than the middle. Feeling absolutely overjoyed and upbeat, or crushed and dejected, came easier than simply feeling content. My Uncle Hoyt Jr. used to call me cheerful, because I was either ecstatically happy, swinging on swings is awesome, or inconsolably sad. My ice cream fell and life is meaningless. I wasn't an unhappy child. I just could never quite settle on a definition for happiness that made sense to me. And I was naturally curious, extremely skeptical, and always probing. I don't mean the kind of kid who asked a million, but why? Questions. I was the type who asked the existential ones, how do you know what you say is good is actually good? If my dream seems so real, how do I know I'm not still asleep and dreaming? In kindergarten, when we sang If You're Happy and You Know It, I always hesitated to clap my hands. Was I really happy? What do people feel when they say they feel happy? And what if I don't feel like that? Fast forward to adult me, and I still have questions. What is happiness, really? And how would I know if I felt it? Right now, you're probably saying, this girl is really overthinking things, and you would be the first, or you wouldn't be the first. But hear me out. I've worked and written for women's magazines for more than 2 decades. I have edited dozens of stories about 10 ways to find your joy, 25 reasons to be happy, 15 things to make you smile. All of them true. All of them from the heart, but also all kind of BS. Sometimes being happy is hard. Some things are just up. Trump is the president. Your favorite rapper may be problematic. Folks in Flint, Michigan still can't trust that water coming out of their taps. Black people are still being disrespected and brutalized in the gym, at Starbucks, in their cars, and even in their backyards. And personally, I've gone through 2 knee replacement surgeries and the subsequent pain, physical and financial, that came with it. I've been laid off full-time jobs twice, and I am now doing the temp freelance gig economy hustle, trying to pay the relentless flurry of bills with money that arrives in dribs and drabs, chasing checks, grinding. It's exhausting. It's a lot. Added to that, the chorus of other people's happiness that seemingly stays on autoplay. Is it me, or has it almost become performance art? People just can't take a walk in the park or a stroll on the beach or have a great hair day. No, they have to put it on the gram, where every occurrence or occasion is the best ever. I look at those posts and pictures and think, have I ever felt as overjoyed about anything as these girls are about their avocado toast? Has anybody? Remember that time when everybody went to Dubai? Most have had some cheap tickets. I think that's what it meant. I think it's a typo here. In my feed, high school friends, former coworkers, and old neighbors and relatives were all studying in Dubai. And there I was, at home in Hoboken, and wondering, where's my photo shoot on a sand dune? Can this broke black girl get some of that hashtag black girl magic? Now, I'm not saying that I'm not amazing, because I am. But some days, okay, many days, it feels as if y'all and not me. Honestly, the season of Dubai could have been the start of my hopelessly feeling sorry for myself, a terrible spiritual. But that one time I stopped myself cold. You can do this too. I had a stern talk with myself about myself. A life of contentment had always been sitting there waiting on me to calm or to claim happiness as mine. Getting a grip on my perspective was the clear and only answer I admitted to myself, that cheap tickets or not, I have never even wanted to go to Dubai. Why send my wishes and dreams on someone else's vacation? Instead of focusing on big, flashy events like other people's travel to exotic locales, I start to fill my thoughts with those small moments that bring me real joy. Warm puppies, mastering new skills, rain showers on really hot afternoons, and how awesome it is still to swing on a swing. And one day I looked up and was happy. Not only in a let me count my blessings way, though my blessings are many and wondrous, I have a husband who loves me as much as I love him, friends and family I adore, good health, a roof over my head, and food on the table. But in an even deeper sense, being content is a way of seeing the world and your place in it. And it can happen through little life rituals that lift your spirit. Today, I laugh despite the bills. Sometimes I skip to my mailbox on my two new knees. Why not? I even take dance classes or dance breaks whenever The Boss by Diana Ross comes on in the grocery store. That's me singing out loud in the public. You know, I never pass up the opportunity to ride a carousel. And sometimes I'm just really satisfied with the way my avocado toast tastes. I'm happy. I know it. I clap my hands. That was a good feel-good article. So let's move on to another article. Oh, it's somewhat related to the article we just that I just read. Happy and we know it. So if you believe the whole of it, the health and wealth disparities, implicit and explicit bias, patriarchy, misogyny, generations of servitude, Jim Crow, and post-traumatic slave syndrome, relentless efforts to police our bodies, whitewash our minds, co-opt our style, and snuff out our black girl magic. Black women are not supposed to be here, but still we rise. We're standing tall, blossoming in the hard soil of an America that can be stingy with its dreams. We are not only here, but we are happy with ourselves, in our brown bodies, and in the company of one another. Even though our progress is slow in areas like equal pay and physical wellness, research shows black women consistently reporting satisfaction with their lives overall. How do we do it? Chronic stress leads to worse health conditions in black women compared with white women. The stress from racial trauma can lead to increased abdominal fat, contributing to excess weight and deliberating problems and whittles away parts of our chromosomes, accelerating aging. Racism complicates our pregnancies and is a major factor in black maternal and infant deaths. Yet we manage to be happy, at peace, at ease, and fulfilled. The black women continue to rise above assaults on psyche and spirit, especially in the era of white supremacy run amok, is a testament to the grit and grace of our ancestors. Our resiliency can come at a cost when we don't tend to our own needs, as some of us recovering superwomen learn the hard way. But protective factors that service us well in the face of stressors include our spiritual beliefs and practices, supportive family relationships, and ride or die sister friends. Here's a look at ways we find our joy and keep it. So number one, we lean on one another. We look to one another because often we know that we're all we've got. Black women are constantly made aware that those outside of our community generally don't understand who we truly are, nor do they often have our best interests in mind, says Bianca C. Williams, PhD, author and associate professor of anthropology at the CUNY Graduate Center in New York City. An awareness of our marginalization pushes us to find ways to define ourselves for ourselves, to look within for the strength we need to endure and succeed, and to look to other black women for support. Number two, we keep the faith. Those who said they were very involved in their church or mosque or meditation center or another spiritual home reported excellent or very good mental health in findings from an exclusive 20-year black women's health study reported by the Black Women's Health Imperative. That's no surprise. We are a deeply spiritual people, with more than 80% of us describing religion as very important. In 1990, when she was an adolescent, Valencia Moses Brand, age 41, was brought low by the loss of two grandfathers and a grand aunt in just 5 months. At that age, you think people are going to be there forever, she says, but you had to rely on God and know that he didn't make any mistake. It was a time for praying and asking God to get you through. And we feel good about ourselves. About 40% of BWHS participants reported living with one or more major health conditions, while at the same time, approximately half of participants reported having excellent, very good, or good overall physical health. What gives? A 2010 Morehouse School of Medicine study showed that black women sometimes underestimate the degree to which we are at risk for developing health conditions like diabetes and heart diseases. Yes, we love our curves, but as the study's authors suggest, while this may be protective to the self-esteem for African American women, it stands to reason that us underestimating their weight category places these women at higher risk for continuance of overweight and obesity. We give back. We know that giving time and resources benefits our communities. Just ask any sister involved in a ministry or a public service organization. Keisha Patrick, age 39, a lawyer for a federal agency in Washington, D.C., who serves as a youth and young adult minister at her church, says the current political and social climate reminds her of her purpose. "One way I find peace is to pursue justice and change," she says. "Studies show that not only our volunteers more likely to report greater psychological well-being and a lower risk of high blood pressure from giving back approximately 4 hours per week, but they are also more likely to live longer. Beware, Black women with lifetime commitments to treasured organizations are prone to giving and doing too much, leading to a stress and burnout." Moses Brand, an elementary school teacher from Florence, South Carolina, recalls being in leadership roles in four organizations plus her church. She was considering teaching an evening community college class when her oldest son stopped her cold with, "When are you going to have time for us?" "Also consider that you could be hiding behind a packed volunteer schedule to keep from focusing on your own problems. Know why you want to help other people," says Rhonda Wilbon, a clinical psychotherapist and associate professor of social work at Morgan State University in Baltimore. "It's probably an experience that you've had. You want to have that settle. What's worse is to try to help other people, but not having worked through your own issues." And then another one is, "We stay close and stay woke. Whether by blood or informal ties, kinship not only connects us to an African heritage, but it helps us to persevere in the face of harsh realities." Moses Brand, who with her husband Johnny is raising two boys, ages 9 and 13, has already had the talk that many parents of Black children feel compelled to have. "I tell them if you get stopped by the police, make sure that they can see your hands and comply with their requests." She's concerned about how her boys are interpreting reports of innocent people getting shot or killed. "We try to get our 9-year-old to understand when he sees this on the news and asks why. It's hard to let them know that everybody's justice isn't the same." And we're going to stop right here because it looks like that we've run out of time, and I will follow back up in the August edition going over some of these reasonings since this Essence magazine is for July and August. So again, we've run out of time for today's episode of Essence magazine. We hope that you've enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I'm Nicole Hunter, reading for the Triangle Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a blind and print impaired audience. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, triangleReadingService.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. We'll be right back.